Every spring, as celebrities walk the red carpet at the Oscars, designers at companies like Fabiana are watching intently, not just to admire the fashion, but to create celebrity look-alike gowns that will sell for $200 to $500 compared to the original's multi-thousand-dollar price tags. Surprisingly, this copying is perfectly legal, as fashion designs aren't protected by copyright law in the United States. Yet, despite this rampant copying, the fashion industry continues to thrive creatively. This paradox challenges our fundamental assumptions about innovation and intellectual property. The Constitution grants Congress power to create patents and copyrights to promote the progress of science and useful arts, reflecting the traditional view that creators need control over copying to incentivize creation. But what happens in industries where copyright and patent don't apply? In fashion, cuisine, comedy, and other creative fields, innovation remains vibrant despite free copying. Sometimes copying even spurs innovation, a crucial insight as technology makes copying increasingly easier. This knockoff economy reveals that creativity and copying can not only coexist, but sometimes even benefit each other, offering an optimistic counterpoint to fears that easier copying will destroy creative industries. When Paris Hilton appeared on Letterman wearing a flower-printed Foley Purina dress, Forever 21 quickly produced a nearly identical copy. This practice is ubiquitous in fashion because American copyright law doesn't protect clothing designs. According to conventional wisdom about innovation, such rampant copying should destroy creativity. Yet the opposite has occurred. The American apparel industry has flourished over decades of uncontrolled copying, with greater design diversity than ever before. Fashion evolved from a Paris-centered, handmade industry to a global, mass-produced phenomenon worth over $1.3 trillion annually. The transformation began with the sewing machine in the mid-19th century, with America pioneering ready-to-wear clothing. By the 21st century, fashion conglomerates like LVMH controlled the high-end market, while fast fashion retailers like Zara, H&M, and Forever 21 transformed the industry by rapidly producing cheap knockoffs of runway designs. Despite complaints about copying dating back to at least the 1920s, fashion designs have never been legally protected against copying in America. This stems from copyright law's treatment of useful articles, goods where creativity and practicality are intertwined. While a painting has no functional use and can be protected, a dress serves a function, even if artistically designed. This creates curious distinctions. Jewelry can be copyrighted as ornamental, but an ornate dress cannot. A two-dimensional sketch of a design is protected, but the three-dimensional garment isn't. Attempts to protect fashion designs date back to the 1930s, when the Fashion Originators Guild of America formed a cartel to combat copying. The guild registered American designs and pressured retailers to boycott anyone copying registered designs. By 1936, the guild controlled 60% of women's garments sold above 1075. However, in 1941, the Supreme Court ruled the guild's practices violated antitrust law, effectively ending this experiment in self-regulation. The debate resurfaced with the rise of fast fashion, leading to the 2006 Design Piracy Prohibition Act and its 2009 successor, the Innovative Design Protection and Piracy Prevention Act. Despite warnings that 750,000 jobs were at risk, these efforts remained unsuccessful, leaving fashion design unprotected after 200 years of free copying in America. How does the fashion industry remain creative despite extensive copying? The answer lies in fashion's unusual economics and its function as a status signal. Unlike practical goods, high-end fashion items are positional goods, purchased largely for what they say about the owner's status relative to others. This status value is two-sided. A design is most coveted when enough people have it to signal desirability, but its value diminishes when it becomes too common. This creates the fashion cycle. New designs catch on, become trends, spread, become overexposed, and die, making way for new designs. Legal rules permitting copying actually accelerate this cycle. Copying speeds diffusion, which hastens decline, which intensifies demand for new designs. Unlike cell phones that improve with new features, clothes simply change. And that change, accelerated by copying, drives consumers to buy new items. Copying thus paradoxically fuels creativity rather than stifling it. People buy clothing for practical reasons, but expensive designer purchases are driven by desire for expression and status. As John Cocteau noted, art produces ugly things which frequently become more beautiful with time. Fashion produces beautiful things which always become ugly with time. The fashion cycle follows this pattern. New designs catch on, spread, become overexposed, and fade away, as exemplified by UGG boots, which rose to must-have status in 2003-2004 before facing backlash and decline. Copying functions as fashion substitute for product improvement. Legal freedom to copy accelerates this cycle, making designs obsolete faster by eroding their positional value. Data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics confirms this theory. Between 1998 and the present, prices of women's dresses remained stable across all price categories, except the most expensive 10%, which increased by over 250%. This suggests knockoffs don't harm high-end originals. If they did, competition would have depressed luxury prices. Copying not only accelerates the fashion cycle, but helps consumers navigate style through a process called anchoring. Despite the flood of new designs each season, identifiable trends emerge through an undirected process of copying, referencing, and reworking. As one observer noted, if there were not imitation, there could be no fashion. Copying both creates trends and eventually kills them. By anchoring each season around a limited number of themes that all producers can work with, copying helps consumers identify what's in style. While social norms and first mover advantage might explain how some creative industries thrive despite copying, their role in fashion appears relatively modest. Unlike other industries, norms don't meaningfully constrain copying in the apparel industry. The Gasperia incident, where the designer openly admitted to copying a vintage Kaisik Wong design, illustrates this. Far from being embarrassed, Gasperia compared his copying to music sampling and expressed confidence it wouldn't hurt his reputation. If copying accelerates the fashion cycle and drives more sales, why don't designers knock off their own designs? Some theorists suggest firms should offer cheaper, visibly inferior versions of their products. But brand protection concerns prevent this direct approach. Instead, we see diffusion, or bridge lines, lower-priced clothing under related but distinct labels, like Marc by Marc Jacobs. In the culinary world, copying is rampant, yet creativity flourishes. The restaurant industry generates over $600 billion annually in America, yet chefs enjoy minimal legal protection for their creations. Recipes cannot be copyrighted, and anyone can taste a dish, reverse engineer it, and recreate it elsewhere. This paradox mirrors fashion's creative ecosystem despite widespread imitation. For millennia, chefs worked in obscurity until the 19th century when figures like Carême and Escoffier achieved public recognition. America's culinary landscape transformed dramatically from a wasteland to a sophisticated food culture beginning mid-20th century. By the 1970s-80s, a culinary revolution emerged, led by Wolfgang Puck, Alice Waters, and others, as chefs became celebrities and restaurants became sites of artistic appreciation. Today's modernist cuisine movement represents the pinnacle of culinary innovation, with chefs using complex techniques to create edible special effects that diners pay dearly to experience. Despite the explosion of culinary creativity, copying remains widespread. Innovative dishes like molten chocolate cake, created by Jean-Georges von Guericken, or miso-glazed black cod by Nobu Matsuhisa, quickly spread to other restaurants in slightly altered forms. The original creators can claim no royalties nor halt others from interpreting their creations. Unlike paintings or sculptures of food, which would receive copyright protection, the actual dishes themselves aren't protected under current law. This stems from the distinction between recipes, ingredients and instructions, and built food, the actual edible creation. Neither receives copyright protection, as recipes are considered functional procedures rather than creative expressions. While chefs can freely copy recipes and dishes, they cannot copy entire restaurant concepts or trademarked elements. In the Pearl Oyster Bar versus Ed's Lobster Bar dispute, Rebecca Charles's legal complaint focused on trade dress violations, the distinctive look and feel of her restaurant, rather than dish ownership. Trade dress, similar to trademark law, protects consumers from confusion while safeguarding creators from imitation. The culinary world is increasingly questioning why food creations don't receive the same legal protections as other art forms. This debate came to a head in 2005 when Robin Wickens, chef at Australia's Interlude restaurant, was caught copying innovative dishes from American restaurants like Alinea and WD50 without attribution after staging, interning at Alinea. Many chefs condemned Wickens not for copying techniques, which is expected in the open-source tradition of staging, but for failing to attribute his inspirations and for replicating dishes verbatim rather than evolving them. As one commenter noted, it was like re-recording Miles Davis's Kinda Blue note for note and selling it for profit without crediting the original. Despite the absence of copyright protection for recipes, culinary innovation continues to flourish. Many prominent chefs express ambivalence about the very concept of owning dishes. David Chang of Momofuku believes there is nothing new under the sun. Our job is just to make existing dishes better. Thomas Keller questions his right to claim ownership of his famous salmon cornets, wondering if they're merely his reinterpretation of ice cream cones. Social norms among elite chefs act as powerful restraints on copying, despite weak legal protections. Fauchart and von Hippel's study of French chefs identified three key norms. Chefs shouldn't copy recipes exactly, shouldn't share others' information without permission, and should provide proper attribution. These norms are enforced through reputation damage and social exclusion. Violators face public exposure, loss of professional standing, and denial of access to future innovations. Unlike digital goods that can be perfectly duplicated, cuisine is inherently analog. No version of a dish is truly identical to another. Consumers experience something distinct from the original when eating a copy, perhaps better, perhaps worse, but certainly different. These differences create marketplace differentiation, with copies sometimes even functioning as advertisements for originals. Chefs often welcome copying because it builds their reputation for bold, innovative cooking. Many French chefs openly reveal their methods, believing disclosure increases personal reputation, generates publicity, informs potential patrons, stakes claim to an innovation space, and promotes regional products. Today, public renown can be more valuable than peer respect, as chefs have become celebrities through food media. The Food Network draws more viewers than cable news, with shows like Chefography and Top Chef creating mass food appreciation culture. Perhaps copying isn't a threat to innovation, but actually enables it. Like open-source software, culinary innovation may thrive through collective, incremental processes that require sharing ideas. As Ferran Audria, Heston Blumenthal, and Thomas Keller declared, culinary traditions are collective, cumulative inventions, a heritage created by hundreds of generations of cooks. Applying copyright to recipes might disrupt this centuries-old process. Modern cocktail culture mirrors cuisine's creative renaissance, with innovative drinks pushing boundaries far beyond traditional offerings. Though recipes can't be copyrighted, some attempt protection through trademarks. Pusser's Rum claims the painkiller cocktail, while Gosling's defends the Dark and Stormy. Yet like cuisine, cocktails thrive on openness and sharing despite copying. This balance of innovation, sharing, and commercial success demonstrates how creativity flourishes without traditional copyright protection. The chapter opens with comedian Joe Rogan confronting Carlos Mencia at the Comedy Store in 2007, accusing him of stealing jokes from lesser-known comic Ari Shaffir. This explosive confrontation, captured on video and viewed over 5 million times on YouTube, sparked a major feud in the comedy world. Mencia denied the accusations, calling Rogan jealous and a whiny bitch, but Shafir himself joined Rogan on stage to support the theft allegations. American stand-up comedy evolved from vaudeville, where comedy was just one element in variety shows. During this era, joke theft was common and openly acknowledged. Milton Berle was nicknamed Thief of Bad Gags and joked about dropping his pencil while watching other performers. Around the Kennedy era, comedy shifted toward more personal, narrative-driven performances pioneered by Mort Sahl and Lenny Bruce, focusing on politics, race, and sex. This new style, embraced by comics like Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock, emphasized originality and personal perspective, making copying less acceptable. Despite jokes being protectable as literary works under copyright law, comedians rarely sue each other over theft. This is partly due to legal costs, but more importantly, because of copyright's idea expression distinction. Only the specific wording of a joke is protected, not its underlying premise. Since premises can be reworded while preserving the humor, legal protection is minimal. In place of copyright enforcement, comedians have developed a system of social norms to protect originality. These informal rules both mirror and extend beyond copyright law. They prohibit performing another comedian's material and, unlike copyright, protect both expression and underlying ideas. Enforcement occurs through escalating punishments, bad-mouthing, ostracism, refusal to work with the offender, and occasionally threats or physical violence. Though legally questionable, these sanctions effectively regulate the community, as allegations of joke theft can seriously damage or even destroy a comedian's career. The fundamental norm in comedy is the taboo against copying, enshrined as the first commandment in guides like the Comedy Bible. Unlike copyright law, comedians' norms protect both expression and ideas. Even adding minor specificity to a general premise, like sex in a church becoming sex in a church caught by a priest, makes both the joke and its premise off-limits to others. Despite comedy's collaborative nature, comedians reject copyright's joint authorship principles in favor of a simpler rule. Whoever originated the premise owns the entire joke, even if another comic contributed the punchline. This prevents confusion about ownership that could undermine the anti-copying norm. Similarly, joke sales happen through handshakes rather than written agreements, with the understanding that the buyer gains complete ownership. The original writer can't even publicly claim authorship. When copying is suspected, comedians typically confront each other directly. If no resolution is reached, the aggrieved comic employs two main sanctions: attacks on reputation and refusals to deal. Bad-mouthing the copyist and turning other comics against them can effectively make them a leper in the community. Booking agents, many former comedians themselves, often refuse to work with known thieves, relegating them to low-class venues. In 1950, Princeton student John Bogle discovered that actively managed mutual funds generally failed to beat market averages. After being fired from Wellington Management in 1974, Bogle founded the Vanguard Group and introduced the first index fund in 1976. Despite initial skepticism, Bogle's folly, Vanguard grew explosively to become America's largest mutual fund company. Though Bogle never patented his innovation, and couldn't have at the time, competitors were slow to copy his idea, perhaps because index funds generate lower management fees. Football transformed dramatically when the forward pass was introduced in the early 20th century as a safety measure following 18 college player deaths in 1905. This innovation made the game more complex and interesting, eventually becoming essential to winning. Football's evolution has featured continuous waves of innovative offensive strategies and defensive counter strategies. Yet none of these innovations receive copyright or patent protection. Coaches continue innovating because underdogs need innovations to compete. The rewards of winning are immediate, and practical barriers provide a brief but crucial first-mover advantage before rivals can effectively copy new strategies. Football illustrates how innovation comes from both pioneers who create radically new concepts and tweakers who refine them. The evolution of offensive formations demonstrates this perfectly, from traditional power formations like the wishbone to the spread offense pioneered by Mouse Davis and tweaked by Mike Leach, who spaced out linemen, moved to shotgun formation, and accelerated play tempo. These continuous tweaks show how football's creativity flourishes through refinement, with each innovation exposing weaknesses that inspire the next round of creativity. The value of tweaking extends far beyond football. The compulsory license provision of the 1909 Copyright Act allows musicians to record cover songs without permission by paying specified fees, a rule originally created to prevent the Aeolian company from monopolizing the player piano music market. This freedom to tweak songs has enriched musical culture immeasurably, with artists like Jimi Hendrix transforming Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower and countless musicians reinterpreting Van Morrison's Gloria. Despite their artistic elements, fonts fall under the category of pictorial, graphical, or sculptural works that serve a utilitarian purpose, constructing words and sentences, which exempts them from copyright protection. For centuries, the inapplicability of copyright to fonts didn't matter because printing technology made them difficult to copy. Creating metal letter forms required skilled punch cutters and approximately 800 hours of work. This changed in the late 19th century with photography and pantographs, and dramatically transformed in the early 20th century with photogravure typesetting. The digital revolution made copying virtually costless. Yet despite this ease of copying, font creativity thrives. Estimates suggest growth from 3,600 fonts in 1974 to over 100,000 today. While digitization made copying fonts trivial, it also dramatically reduced the barriers to creating them. Pre-digital font design required substantial investment in equipment and skilled craftsmen. Now, anyone with design talent, a computer, and inexpensive software can create fonts. The number of professional font designers has increased 5 to 10 times, but more significantly, thousands of amateurs have entered the field. The creative industries explored in this book share important cross-cutting features and lessons about innovation and imitation. 6 key lessons emerge. Trends and fads play a powerful role in creative industries. Social norms can shape copying even when legal actions fail. Creators have redefined goods from products into performances. Open source methods lower innovation costs. First mover advantages make innovation profitable despite later copying. And brands and trademarks limit copy market share while copies can serve as advertisements for brands. Copying in fashion creates 2 unexpected effects that make it essential to innovation. First, induced obsolescence accelerates the fashion cycle as designs spread, lose appeal for early adopters, and create demand for new designs. Second, anchoring occurs as trends made by copying provide consumers information about what's stylish while helping designers know what will sell. Together, these effects create the piracy paradox, where copying helps rather than harms creativity. Social norms can significantly shape and constrain copying effects, as demonstrated in comedy, cuisine, and magic communities. These norm systems work best among rival creators rather than mass consumer copying, and function better for individuals than firms. While not preventing all copying, norms provide extra legal means of redress that often better reflect industry-specific needs than formal IP law. When products can be perfectly copied and sold cheaply, creators face challenges. However, some products resist perfect copying, either because they're analog rather than digital, like a chef's handmade dessert, or because they're fundamentally about experiences rather than objects. The experiential nature of consumption provides shelter from copying's effects. A Momofuku pork bun eaten at Momofuku represents an entire aesthetic experience customers willingly pay for: the energy, crowd, decor, and culinary vision. Wikipedia's triumph over Microsoft's Encarta illustrates how openness fosters innovation. While Microsoft created a proprietary encyclopedia, Wikipedia invited volunteers to contribute freely. Open source represents a broad method of creation, collaborative, focused on sharing, found in unexpected places like top restaurant kitchens. The success of open source software like Mozilla Firefox, Linux, and Apache demonstrates how revealing source code encourages improvement and innovation. First mover advantage refers to the period of de facto exclusivity innovators enjoy before others can successfully copy their creation. This advantage can provide sufficient incentive for innovation even without IP protection. While intellectual property laws artificially extend this period, many industries thrive on natural barriers to copying alone. In football, coaches continue innovating despite easy copying, because they need immediate results and because formations often depend on specific team compositions that can't be quickly replicated. Brands play a surprisingly powerful role in fostering creativity in low IP industries. The market demonstrates consumers' willingness to pay substantial premiums for branded products even when functionally identical alternatives exist. Advil ibuprofen costs nearly 3 times as much as generic versions, yet maintains 51% market share decades after patent expiration. This brand premium creates an innovation incentive. When innovators link their creations to successful brands, they maintain pricing power even after being copied. When we step back from specific industries and consider what drives creativity broadly, two fundamental factors emerge: creation costs and expected returns. While many create for passion, sustained innovation ultimately requires adequate incentives. This principle underpins both traditional IP theory and our more nuanced account of creativity's resilience in copy-prone industries. Two key points make us optimistic about innovation's future. First, creators systematically overestimate their potential benefits, which paradoxically increases creative output. Second, creation costs are dropping across many fields, further stimulating innovation. Together, these factors suggest creativity can thrive even amid rampant copying. Research in economics and psychology reveals that people systematically misjudge their future prospects, displaying pronounced optimism bias. They believe they'll succeed where others failed and heavily discount failure possibilities. This bias extends to creative endeavors, where creators dramatically overvalue their work compared to potential buyers. This optimism bias effectively subsidizes innovation by encouraging creators to invest more in their work than rational calculation would justify. Many creative markets function as winner-take-all or tournament systems, where small performance differences translate into enormous reward disparities. The superstars at the top receive immense compensation, while those just below them earn dramatically less. These tournament dynamics amplify small differences in performance into massive reward inequalities. Logically, one might expect people to avoid such risky markets, where the difference between success and failure remains uncertain until after years of investment. Yet remarkably, large numbers compete intensely to become sports stars, politicians, CEOs, musicians, writers, or creators of the next revolutionary web concept. Innovation depends not just on anticipated benefits, but also on expected costs. As innovation becomes cheaper and easier, we should expect more of it. Technology has dramatically reduced these costs across many industries. Music production exemplifies this shift. Just decades ago, producing an album required expensive studios and engineers. Today, artists can create professional recordings at home using affordable software. Distribution costs have plummeted even more dramatically. Instead of manufacturing and shipping physical media worldwide, artists can instantly upload digital files online. The music industry's battle against copying offers crucial insights into the complex relationship between imitation and innovation. While illegal downloading devastated record company revenues, dropping 60% in a decade, musical creativity itself is flourishing. This paradox reveals two key points. First, while copying harmed parts of the music industry, technology simultaneously lowered production and distribution costs, actually increasing the supply of new music. Second, the industry's plight might be addressed by adopting practices from copying-resistant industries like fashion and comedy. Throughout this book, we've explored industries where creativity thrives despite extensive copying. Rather than dying, these industries are flourishing, a puzzle for conventional thinking about innovation, which assumes imitation kills creativity. All these observations point toward a counterintuitive but fundamentally positive message. Creativity can persist and even thrive despite widespread copying. In some cases, creativity occurs because of copying. The knockoff economy already exists. The important question is how to understand and ultimately harness imitation's power to further innovation.